You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new sculpture in downtown Appleton is shaking up the scenery for local residents. Some pleased, others less so. We'll talk with the artist and then look at the role of public art. Right now, it's time for a Wisconsin News Roundup, checking with reporters around the state about the stories they're covering. First, UW La Crosse has released two investigations into Joel Elgin, a former art professor who was accused of sexual harassment while employed at the school. Hope Kerwin is a WPR News reporter based in La Crosse. Hope, thanks for joining us.
Happy to do it.
Can you remind us first how these allegations against this UW La Crosse art professor first came up?
Yeah, so the public first learned about these allegations in a public Facebook post made by a student in September of in 2019. That student had reported Joel Elgin, the former art department chair, to UWL in March and said that the UW officials failed to follow up with her after that report of sexual harassment. And the student just felt that the university had not taken enough action to protect her and other students from, you know, this harasser.
Now we've got results from, as I understand it, two investigations from UW System and UW La Crosse. What kind of conclusions did they release?
Yeah, so we know that UWL conducted a first investigation when this student came forward. And then after the public Facebook post was made in September, UWL asked UW System to come in and do a second investigation. And so UWL this week released the reports, that the summary reports of these two different investigations. And they show a kind of two different stories. On the one hand, the UWL report that first came out, you know, it basically found that there was insufficient evidence to sustain a finding that Joel Elgin had violated university policy. It describes that university officials gave guidance to Elgin on appropriate instructor-student interactions and had directed him not to have contact with the student who reported him. But that was kind of the end of that investigation. By comparison, the UW System report found that Elgin did sexually harass the student who reported him, and based on interviews with three former students and one current student who came forward after the student made that public Facebook post, based on their interviews, the University System investigators also found that Elgin had conducted unacceptable behavior, is how they described it, with several other students.
Is Elgin still at the university?
No, Elgin retired from the university in December, and in a statement from his lawyer said that he chose to retire after university attorneys advised him that some of his retirement benefits were at risk if he chose to kind of face the conclusions of this investigation.
And he, as I understand it, still denies these the allegations against him?
Yes, he does deny any claim of sexual harassment, and you know, has said through his attorney that you know, he feels the UW System investigation was not impartial, that it did not include supportive statements from students and faculty that were given or included much of his testimony, and has basically said that the university caved to pressure from students and from the community.
We have these reports out now. He's left the university. Is that it for this story, or are there more follow-ups you're watching for?
No, there's definitely some dissatisfaction among students and other you know, people in the university community about how this was handled by UWL. And so UWL Chancellor Joe Gao has said that the administration will hold an open forum on February 12th to discuss these two reports and discuss how this case was handled and any other issues that, you know, kind of come out of this report. So this conversation is definitely not over.
Hope, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hope Kerwin is a WPR reporter based in La Crosse. She talked to us about the release of two investigations into a former UW La Crosse professor accused of sexual harassment. Next, when Semco Windows and Doors in Merrill closed on New Year's Eve, it left 140 employees out of work. Now their union is saying the layoff violated the law. Megan Stringer is the Streetwise reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald. Megan, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
What do we know, Megan, about why Semco closed?
So in a letter that the owner, Patrick Sumlane, wrote to both the state and employees, it seems to be a financial issue. He says that there weren't enough orders or cash and could not find a buyer for the company. So that is about all we know about why the company closed.
And from the workers' perspective, they found out with at most about one day's notice. Is that right?
Something like that, depending on the worker, yes. I spoke with three former SEMCO employees who received their letters in the mail on January 2nd. They were dated January 30th, saying the plant would close, December 30th, rather, saying the plant would close December 31st.
Now, the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters is saying that that notice was actually a violation of law. What are they pointing to?
So they point to federal and state laws. On the state level, Wisconsin's business closing and mass layoff law, and on the federal level, the WARN Act. Both in some form or another require 60 days notice for a closure. At the state level, it impacts companies of 50 or more employees, and at the federal level, companies with 100 or more employees. So SEMCO would apply to both of those, the union says.
What is the union seeking then for those laid off employees?
So there are damages for employees under those laws if they are found to be violated, and that is 60 days worth of pay and benefits. In this case, 60 days. It would be, every day pay and benefit that notice was required but not given.
And how does the union plan to go about making that happen?
So their first step is just to reach out to the company. They have not filed a claim with the state or at the federal level. They want to just be able to talk with the owner first and work things out that way if possible. They say that's always the better option.
And has the company itself, the now closed company SEMCO, said anything in response to this argument?
I have not heard back from him. I put in multiple calls and I have not personally received a response.
Megan, thanks a lot for the update.
Thank you.
Megan Stringer is the Streetwise reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald. She talked with us about the abrupt layoff of workers at SEMCO Windows and Doors in Merrill, which a union now says violated the law. Now officials in Port Washington are weighing options for how to repair the city's breakwater after it was damaged in a major winter storm earlier this month. Kristen Halbig-Ziem is the Port Washington reporter for the Ozaukee Press. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for talking to me.
Let's talk about the breakwater in Port Washington. It serves a practical purpose, of course, but I understand when it's seasonable weather, people like to walk out on it, too. It's not just a practical thing here.
That's true. And sometimes they even go out, brave the lake when it's not so seasonable.
Now, let's talk about this storm on January 11th. You and your colleagues had some just crazy pictures of the water and how high it got. Can you talk about the storm and the damage it caused?
Oh, sure. The storm was I guess you would call it almost a typical Lake Michigan gale. I mean, it was pretty incredible. But it was made worse. You know, we've had storms like this before, big winds, big waves. But because the water level is so high, everything was magnified. And the waterfront just took a beating. And our breakwater, for the most part, held up. You know, structurally, it's sound. But the portion that's closest to the shore, portions of it were undermined. A portion of the walkway was washed away, popped out of its supports and popped out. So it was pretty ferocious.
What kind of costs is the city looking at now to try to repair that damage and make the walkway walkable again?
Well, that's unknown at this point. Last week, the Common Council approved spending $14,000. There was about a 10 to a 30-foot portion that was undermined, and they approved spending $14,000 just to fill in that area. They don't yet know what the cost of replacing the portion of walkway that was popped out, what that will be, or the railing that was knocked off.
Now, I've heard from other communities dealing with flood infrastructure damage, often in northern Wisconsin on Lake Superior. Okay, this storm, this flood damaged this, and then are we going to rebuild it just like it was? Or are we going to try to strengthen it for the next storm that's like that? Is that a debate? Is that a question that's going on in Port Washington right now?
Absolutely, and I think it is everywhere. The city is talking, this portion that was undermined, they're using a process and a I believe they called it a concrete slurry, that they've used before, and they said that's held in the past, so that's doing well. But they're also talking about spending perhaps as much as $25,000 to bring in some more armor stones, big giant boulders, to protect that area. They've worked with the Army Corps to shore up the rest of the breakwater in the past, but this area doesn't have the larger stones, so...
And is there a timeline on when whatever the repairs look like are going to happen?
Well, they're hoping to get that undermined area filled in the next couple weeks. They said as soon as the ice goes away, so if we get a number of days that are warm enough, the ice will melt, and they're hoping to get that taken care of immediately. And, of course, they'd like the walkway open for summer.
Chris, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
Kristen Halbeck-Zeem is the Port Washington reporter at the Ozaukee Press. She talked to us about damage to the city's breakwater after a big winter storm this month and finished out our Wisconsin News Roundup. A recently installed piece of public art near downtown Appleton has stirred a big conversation in the community. Some negative comments from those who oppose it say it's plain ugly, juvenile, belonging in the landfill, even the ugliest piece of art they've ever seen. Others say it's not appropriate for the neighborhood, but they'd be fine with it elsewhere. Supporters of the sculpture in its current place say it lends character to Appleton, and it's nice to have some local modern art without having to drive to a big city to see it. Appleton's Municipal Services Committee voted to rescind the city's approval of the placement. Paul Bobrowitz is a sculpture artist based in Colgate, Wisconsin. His piece is called The Collective, crafted from salvaged propane tanks. His six-acre outdoor gallery located near Holy Hill in southeastern Wisconsin is open to the public to visit. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Well, can you describe The Collective to us? What are we looking at here?
Well, think of a human head formed using individual propane tanks cut into face shapes. And my thinking in making this piece was that it's a compilation of all the influences in my life that have made up me, as well as the collective unconscious, all those who have gone before us that influence our lives in ways that we don't understand.
And now we've got this in place, and it started a conversation. What's it like to hear this back and forth, some very critical, some very positive about this work you put out there?
Well, the conversation or the controversy has grown legs, more so than any other sculpture that I've ever created in my 30-some years of doing this. I can see both sides to it. I also think that there are issues similar to banning books that come to the mind with this conversation. Art, in my mind, is a reflection of the person looking at it. Everybody takes their own personality, their own thing from a piece of art. And it's good that a piece of art stimulates conversation. That's what it should do. It should stimulate emotions, make you think about it, make you feel something. If it hasn't done that, then it's not your thing. Well, if it brings negative thoughts to your mind, then are those negative thoughts a reflection of who you are?
Now, some people have said, you know, this is okay as public art. It's just in the neighborhood. It's kind of a strange fit. What do you think? Could it be somewhere else and that might be a better place for it? Or is the fact that it was in a neighborhood where you wouldn't expect it part of the story here?
Well, I wouldn't call it a neighborhood. It's along a main thoroughfare, College Avenue. It's in a sharp curve in the highway just before the bridge and the high College Avenue crosses a river. I suspect that the reason there's a space here, the grassy strip where it's placed, is because there were probably a lot of accidents on that curve in the past, so the adjoining residential streets have all been dead-ended and can no longer connect to College Avenue, hence this grass strip where it's placed. And I understand that one of the goals in placing this sculpture there, not only it being a very busy place where a lot of people pass through and an entranceway to the downtown area, but the fact that people might slow down and there might be fewer accidents at this sharp curve in the highway. And I understand that is, in fact, happening. So there are good things from this.
Paul, there is a chance it would be moved. There's been so much attention and interest in it. Do you think it'll still find a home in a public place, even if it isn't where it doesn't stay where it is right now?
Well, I understand that there is action, that it is going to be moved, and that it will, in all likelihood, find a new home somewhere in the Appleton area. We'll see what happens.
And, Paul, I've got to say, I think if I were in your shoes, I would not be as, patient and as understanding as you are. This is something you put a lot of work into, and you seem very even-keeled about the controversy.
Well, you know, this piece, I created it not too many, or I finished creating it, not too many weeks before it was selected by the committee for Appleton's appearance. And it, even when it was here in my driveway, and you have to go through a subdivision. I live in a residential area. And my neighbors walk their kids, walk their dogs through my property. I have visitors here on a daily basis. This piece got more reaction from people coming here than any other piece in my 6 acres of sculpture. And there's probably, I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say there's hundreds of sculptures here. And not all of the comments were negative. The negative comments that I did hear while I was here were more of the nature of that I did hear it's scary, but more of the nature that is amazing, and not necessarily in a positive way.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for talking to us about it today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's Paul Bobrowitz, sculpture artist based in Colgate. He created the piece, The Collective, crafted from salvaged propane tanks. It's on display for now in Appleton, maybe going to move soon. Elizabeth Carlson joins us now for a look at the role of public art. She's an associate professor of art history at Lawrence University in Appleton. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Have you taken a look at this sculpture, Elizabeth?
I sure have, yeah.
What do you think about this reaction? It's gotten a lot of attention, for better or worse.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised, actually, at the amount of attention that it's gotten.
And we've seen over the years, I think of the Joe Louis fist in Detroit that initially people were not wild about, but it's become kind of an icon. Do you think if something like this could sit in place for a while, you know, it would be an attraction in the area and maybe less controversial over time?
I mean, it could. I think that one of the signs of success of a public art piece is the conversation, and sometimes that conversation is around controversy. So there's many, many examples of that. I think one of the more famous ones is the Calder sculpture in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is it's a large red sculpture just called The Calder. It has a title, but I don't think most people know it by that title, and it's now become part of the branding of that city. And there's, the Bean in Chicago would be another example, which is Anish Kapoor's Cloud Gate. But that was not necessarily popular by most people when it was first installed. And now it's, people go to Chicago to see the Bean and to take their photo in the Bean.
Can you talk about the role of public art in a community? What goes into why it gets there in the first place?
I think there's a long history in the United States of the importance of public art. That would be mostly publicly funded art. Now, it probably should be said that the collective is privately funded. So it's not people's taxpayers' dollars going into it. And I think that often is the root of the controversy. But in the 1930s, we see a lot of public works with the Federal Art Project, the Public Works for Art Project under the New Deal, Roosevelt's New Deal. Those works were largely there to educate, to beautify. But as you move into the 1960s, there are sort of new goals for public art, and it's very clearly stated that it's there to, you know, ask the public to see the landscape in a new way. And sometimes that way is not the way we want to see it. But it's not the goal, I don't think, in most public art today is really to beautify. And so I think there's sometimes a conflict there in sort of when we say public art, there's multiple publics. And the public can view it, as Paul said, any way they want. But I often think that the goal of public art is to ask the viewer to sort of see the landscape in a way that they're not used to seeing it. So I think that it's possible. I think that when you have controversy, it brings the community together. So I think it could be. It could be something that we look upon fondly in Appleton in 5 or 10 years.
Are you hoping, if it does get moved, and it sounds like it might in just our last few moments, Elizabeth, are you hoping it does end up finding a home in Appleton or nearby?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think this is a sign of a successful public artwork that there's controversy.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Elizabeth Carlson, Associate Professor of Art History at Lawrence College in Appleton. She joined us to talk about public art's role in a community after this sculpture. The collective has gotten a lot of controversy in Appleton. We also heard from the creator of the collective, Paul Bobrowitz. The Senate impeachment trial continues, and today is the last day for Democrats to make their main arguments. Part of today's testimony is centered on whether or not President Trump has obstructed Congress in its investigation of his efforts in Ukraine. That's the second article of impeachment brought by House Democrats. Here's one of the Democratic House managers, U.S. Representative Hakeem Jeffries, on the floor of the Senate today.
At the heart of Article 2, obstruction of Congress, is a simple, troubling reality. President Trump tried to cheat. He got caught, and then he worked hard to cover it up.
David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He focuses on Congress, elections, and race and politics. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Well, it took a while to get to Article 2 today, but overall, what stuck out to you in today's testimony?
Yeah, one surprise was they spent most of the day on Article 1. They didn't really get to Article 2 until about an hour and a half ago. They started with the testimony on Article 2. And so I think the couple of things standing out from today so far was the additional evidence about Ukraine, the withholding of aid. They really hit that pretty hard. I think that's their strongest points that they're making is on the abuse of power. On the obstruction, it's a straightforward argument where they're just saying, look, President Trump defied every subpoena. He told all of the people who the House had been trying to get to testify to not testify. And unlike even Richard Nixon, he has not been cooperative at all. And this is unprecedented in American history. So it's a pretty straightforward argument. Now, on the other hand, the Trump attorneys kind of signaled on Tuesday how they would be defending against those charges. And I think they do have a stronger case here than they do on Article 1, where they basically haven't provided any sort of factual evidence to counter the claims on Article 1. But on Article 2, they make a strong argument saying that, look, the House had their opportunity to go to the courts to try to have these subpoenas enforced. But they were in too much of a hurry. They rushed this process to get it done before Christmas, and therefore they didn't allow President Trump to have his say in court to determine where the boundary should be drawn on executive privilege. Because this is basically the argument they're presenting is that, look, all presidents have claimed executive privilege to some extent, and the courts have never given us a definitive ruling on what privilege should cover or not. And so that's their argument saying, look, the Democrats had their chance, and they should have let this play out in the courts, but instead they decided to go ahead and push this through. And so you can't call it obstruction if all President Trump was trying to do is to have his day in court.
Some people have pointed out a contradiction possibly between that argument from the president's lawyers that this should have been arbitrated in court and the Department of Justice at some point saying courts shouldn't step into this conflict between the president and Congress. Are they undercutting each other's messages there?
No, really good point. In fact, I wanted to bring that up as well as something that is undermining the arguments, I think, right now for President Trump's attorneys. It's the McGahn case, which you're referring to. And there, the Department of Justice has made the argument, and is still today, because that case is on appeal, is still today making the argument that this is an issue that should not be resolved in the courts, but can only be resolved through impeachment. And so, yeah, they really are contradicting their position there. On the one hand, saying that, okay, this is not something for the courts when it's in the McGahn trial, Department of Justice position. Now the Trump's attorney saying, hey, you should have had the courts resolve this.
I want to step back from the details for a moment and look at the overall format here. There's not a format carved into stone for how a Senate impeachment trial is supposed to work. We have this, opening statements from both sides, and then 3 days of Democrats, up to 3 days on the president's side. What do you make of that? Is that the best way to present this information?
I really don't think so. It would have been much better to conduct this more like you would conduct a regular trial, where the prosecution presents its evidence, it calls its witnesses, the defense has an opportunity to cross-examine the witnesses presented by the prosecutor. So there's more of a back and forth. And we saw a taste of that on Tuesday. And I thought Tuesday was a much more interesting day than what we've seen the last 3 days now, because on Tuesday, when they were debating the procedures, that's when you had Chuck Schumer presenting those 11 amendments that were calling for additional witnesses, calling for the documents from the different executive agencies. They've been trying to get documents. And each one of those amendments then was allowed to have 1 hour of debate on each side. And so on Tuesday, you actually saw back and forth between the House managers and Trump's attorneys. And so I thought that made for a much better exchange of ideas, that you had a chance to like rebut the other side's arguments and then come back with your evidence. And I thought that was much more informative for the American people, and indeed even for the Senate, than what we're seeing now, the House going for three straight days, trying to anticipate what the arguments are going to be that President Trump's attorneys are going to make now over the next 3 days. It's just not as effective as allowing more of a back and forth like we saw on Tuesday.
Talking to David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison, looking at the latest in the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump. Democrats, they're in their third and last day of making their case. The president's team starts tomorrow morning, it looks like now, or possibly early afternoon. I can't remember where they ended up falling on that. David, let's get to another big question here that is still not 100% resolved. Are we going to see new witnesses coming before the Senate? What is the latest on that?
Indeed, that is the big question. But on the schedule for tomorrow, they are going to go just from 10 a.m. to noon, because President Trump complained in an early morning tweet, like at 6 in the morning, he was tweeting, hey, not fair that I get stuck on Saturday when TV ratings are bad. And so I think the majority leader was responding to President Trump's concerns there and decided to truncate that opening day to only 2 hours. They'll be 10 a.m. to noon tomorrow for that opening arguments for Trump's attorneys. But yeah, the big question on witnesses, that is definitely what everyone is wondering about right now, is will there be four votes and potentially three if the Chief Justice is willing to break a tie. But four for sure would call for more witnesses. And like people were talking about Lamar Alexander's comment in a break this morning. He said that the House managers have provided overwhelming evidence for Article One. Now, that could be interpreted two ways. That could be interpreted as, he thinks this is pretty convincing evidence that the managers have presented. But the alternative interpretation is, okay, I'm happy with what I've seen. I don't need more witnesses. And in order for there to be a call for new witnesses, you almost certainly would need Alexander, because Murkowski has been wavering a bit. It sounds like Romney and Collins would be the other two most likely. And so if Alexander decides he's seen enough, we almost certainly won't see new witnesses.
And there's been a complaint from some Republicans in the Senate and elsewhere saying we just keep rehashing the same stuff. There's no new information. And Democrats responding, well, then if you want new information, let us have these witnesses that would add more to what we already know.
Well, right. And that is, I think, a crucial point here, is that one of the complaints we've heard from both on the House side during the the impeachment investigation and the hearings, and now in the Senate as well, is that we don't have enough testimony from the firsthand witnesses. That the, you know, some of, and we do have plenty from firsthand witnesses, but not from some of the key players like Mike Pompeo and Mick Mulvaney and John Bolton. You know, these are the folks who were in the room when these decisions really were being made, and we haven't heard from them because they're the folks that President Trump is preventing from testifying. And so it would be good, certainly, for the trial to be able to hear from those people.
You know, John Bolton, that's somebody a lot of people have focused on, briefly national security advisor under President Trump. Democrats seem to think he would bring a lot to support their case. The President Trump has moved around in what he said about Bolton testifying. Eventually, it seems like he doesn't want him there. Is there, can we actually assume what John Bolton would actually say before the Senate? It seems like that would be a real wild card.
It's absolutely a wild card. I think it could go anywhere from being really damaging testimony, you know, for the president. If, for example, he follows up on his comments about how he wasn't going to participate in this drug deal and how Rudy Giuliani is a hand grenade, it's going to blow us all up, and storming out of meetings when the Ukraine withholding the aid came out. So, you know, we have a lot of testimony coming from people who were in the room with Bolton that he was not happy about this. And so it's possible he could offer some pretty compelling firsthand accounts of why he was so upset. But on the other hand, he may have made the calculation that, yeah, he doesn't like what happened with Ukraine and withholding the aid, but he almost certainly is very happy with some other things recently, like with Iran. He's always a real hardliner on Iran, and so he might make the decision that he still would rather have President Trump in office, and so maybe his testimony wouldn't be so damning. You try to play down any of his concerns and have a broader endorsement still of President Trump. That's certainly possible as well. So it's absolutely a wild card.
Talking to David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison, looking at the latest on the Senate impeachment trial as Democrats wrap up their last day of opening arguments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the arguments we've heard from Democrats so far? Do you think the president obstructed Congress in its investigation of Trump? Or do you think the investigation shouldn't have happened in the first place? What questions do you have for our guest about what's happened through the impeachment process so far? Do you think there should be witnesses called by the Senate in addition to whoever testified before House committees? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now about the Senate impeachment trial. Today's last day for Democrats' main arguments. David Cannon is with us from UW-Madison, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're following it, what has stood out to you? What do you make of the case the Democrats have made so far? What do you want to hear from the president's team, his lawyers, when they start tomorrow? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Question for your guest, David. What is the Republicans in the Senate, what is their opinion of Vice President Pence? Would they not see Pence as a qualified president should Trump get impeached or be found guilty? Do they not have, good opinion of Pence? And would Pence perhaps stand a better chance of reelection against a Democratic candidacy or candidate in November?
Mike, thanks for the call. So weighing running under a President Trump or a President Pence there, David?
Yeah, really interesting question. And there was an op-ed that Jeff Flake, the former senator, Republican senator from Arizona, had in, I think it's the Washington Post, maybe 6 months ago. And he said if there could be like a secret vote in the Senate to remove the president, that you would have like 70 votes in favor of removing the president. And so at least he thought that if the Republican senators could vote sincerely instead of strategically, you would actually have most of them preferring Pence to Trump. And so I think the concern that many of them have is that President Trump's supporters are so strongly behind him that going against the president would be political suicide in their reelection campaigns. And so I think there a lot of Republicans may not want to take a public stand against the president for that reason. But they, I think there is a lot of support among Republicans in the Senate for Vice President Trump, Vice President Pence. I don't think that's a problem. So in other words, they're not hesitating to vote Trump out of office because they don't like Pence. It's just that they don't want to go against the president.
Thanks for the call, Mike. We'll go to Owen and Wyawega now. Owen, hi.
Hello. Rob. What astonishes me is how much Trump, and you got to hand it to him, he's enlightened the public on how much politicians are polarized from regular people like me and you. And it's just painfully obvious and clear how corrupt our whole system has become. And I honestly don't think anything's going to come out of this other than what we're seeing right now. Just a lot of rhetoric, and we're stalling and wasting time that we could be doing other things with our politicians other than this, I think.
Owen, thanks for the call. Owen saying we're going to end up after impeachment exactly where we were before impeachment, and it's not a great system in the first place, David.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Owen's right on the outcome. I think that almost everyone agrees that President Trump will not be removed from office, that it's inconceivable that they'll get the two-thirds they need to remove him. And so I think Owen's right that at least from that standpoint, nothing's going to change. But I guess I'm a little more optimistic in terms of, you know, the what this process has done to help educate the American people about what is going on in government. And I think one thing that it's done, if you look at the public opinion polls anyway, you know, large majorities, between 65 and 70% in most polls, are saying they do want to hear more witnesses. They want more transparency. They want more accountability. And so I think that this is something that will almost certainly carry forward to the November elections. And so one thing that I think this will reinforce in our political system is that ultimately the power resides with the people and with voting in elections. And if people are upset about the way things are going and upset about the, as Owen put it, the corruption in politics, then we as voters have a responsibility to go to the polls. And that ultimately, and that's what the Republicans in the Senate are saying, too, is that this should not be resolved through impeachment. It should be resolved through elections. And so that's the one thing that could change things then would be in November in the elections.
Thanks for the call, Owen, at 800-642-1234. Talking about the latest in the Senate impeachment trial with David Cannon from UW-Madison. Back to your calls now. David is with us in Madison. David, hi.
Hi. My concern is they keep going over the same stuff that they've been going over for since the beginning. I watched both the Nadler trials. I watched the Schiff trial, and they're just not moving the needle. Schiff said he was going to read the transcription at the end of yesterday, and he read one sentence, and then he gave his opinion in telling us how to think and how we're supposed to interpret that, which really defies logic. You wouldn't interpret the things the way Schiff is interpreting them, unless you're, well, you just went, I don't know where the guy's coming from. I don't think he's moving the needle, and I don't think putting Bolton on the stand or any of these other guys is going to change the facts. The transcription is the fact, and there's absolutely nothing there.
David, thanks for the call, and different people are looking at that partial transcript of President Trump's call with Ukrainian President Zelensky, and reading it differently, David saying there's nothing there, others saying, yeah, it's pretty bad.
Well, right. And so I guess it's hard to know how to counter folks who have been watching all of it and say that there's no evidence. It sounds like David's been very plugged into watching everything in the Senate and also the House process. And so, it seems like he's been watching everything going on. And given the mountains of evidence that, and even like Lamar Alexander again today said, overwhelming evidence that's been presented by the House managers, that it's and even just the transcript to look at the text of the transcript and to see President Trump conditioning the aide of the Javelin. So right before President Trump talks, the Zelensky talks about how they're going to buy more Javelins for their war with Russia. And President Trump says, okay, yeah, but we need a favor. That is, we need you to investigate the Ukrainian meddling in the election. It wasn't Russia. It was CrowdStrike and where's the server and all of the other things concerning the 2016 election. And then a minute later, he brings in the Bidens and say, yeah, we also want you to investigate the Bidens and the firing of this prosecutor. And so even if you just use that transcript to say that there's nothing troubling about that, that there's no evidence, would open the door to saying that asking for interference in our American elections for personal gain, where you're investigating your chief rival in the upcoming election, to say that that's okay, it's just hard to understand how someone wouldn't be troubled by that. One thing I always urge my students to do in a situation like this, to make sure you're removing partisan bias, because we all have biases, you know, wherever you're coming from, everyone's biased to some extent. So I always ask them to flip the script. And so, like, if you look at that transcript and say it's no problem, would you be okay with, say, a President Elizabeth Warren, you know, contacting Taiwan and telling Taiwan for the next presidential election to investigate her chief rival? And if they don't do that, she's going to withhold the important military aid that they need to protect themselves from mainland China. Would that be okay? Would that be acceptable? And so you really need to always flip the script to make sure that you're not being governed by your own partisan biases and you're actually thinking about the principle at stake here, which is using American taxpayers' dollars, changing our American foreign policy to actually gain advantage in the upcoming presidential election by investigating your chief rival. And so, yeah, that is just, it really is hard to see how people cannot see that as evidence of something that's a problem. Now, people can disagree on whether that's an impeachable offense. I think a completely reasonable position for people to take, if you are a supporter of President Trump, is to say, yeah, but let's let the voters decide that, you know, this is something that, yeah, maybe it's troubling, he shouldn't have done it, but we don't think that's enough to remove him from office through impeachment. That's an entirely defendable position to take and say, yeah, let the voters decide, we'll have this decided in the election. But to say there's no evidence seems to me just flies in the face of what the mountains of evidence that have been presented on this.
Thanks for that call. David, in our last 30 seconds or so, what are you going to watch for as the president's team starts up tomorrow?
Well, it'll be interesting to see how hard they push back in Article 1. Because as I mentioned at the outset, I think they have a much stronger argument in Article 2. And I think they'll push, you know, very hard in Article 2 to say, look, President Trump needed to have his day in court. And the House didn't let him do that. And so I think that's going to be a strong argument. But what I'm interested in seeing is how much they push back on Article 1. Because so far we haven't seen that much. That most of the things they had talked about on Tuesday got shot down pretty quickly by the House managers. And so I'm really curious to see if they do try to present any new documents, new evidence to contest the evidence that the managers had on Article 1.
David, we'll keep watching. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about the last day of opening arguments for Democrats from the House in the Senate impeachment trial. Coming up Monday on Central Time, coronavirus has led to city quarantines in China. The U.S. and other countries are on alert. We'll find out what that virus is and what's known about the current outbreak. We'll get the latest on the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump with a look at the arguments from the president's legal team over the weekend. And a lot of people will watch the Super Bowl in just over a week, but we're going to have some fun. We want you to share a lesser watched sport or team that you like to follow or that you like to play yourself. We'll be inviting your calls. That and more coming up Monday on Central Time.